Do you want more true crime bedtime stories? Sign up to Bonus Bedtime Stories on Apple Podcasts today to access early and ad-free episodes. Subscribers will also get an exclusive bonus episode each month. But for now, get comfortable and enjoy tonight's episode.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to True Crime Bedtime Stories. In this episode, you'll hear one of the most disturbing stories in recent history as we travel to Japan, a country famous for its polite and respectful culture. But in 1988, it was also the scene of a case of shocking violence, a case of culture-shifting depravity and brutality. We'll hear about an entire community of families and law enforcement officials who turned their backs on a helpless teenage girl out of fear of the deadly organized crime syndicate known far and wide as the Yakuza. We're going to explore the tragic tale of Junko Furuta, a bright teenager with a promising future, whose life took an unfathomable turn. Junko was an ordinary 17-year-old high school student from Misato, Saitama, Japan. Known for her good girl image and her popularity among peers, she had dreams, goals, and aspirations like any young person. She worked part-time to save for a trip she had planned and looked forward to a future filled with possibility. But in November 1988, an unimaginable horror began to unravel that would not only cut her life tragically short, but would also leave an indelible scar on the psyche of a nation. In this episode, we will discuss her background and dive into the events of that fateful night when deception led to her abduction. We'll recount the 44 days of inconceivable torment she endured at the hands of her captors. This isn't merely a discussion of a crime, but a stark look into the darkest facets of human nature and the systemic failures that allowed evil to flourish. Brace yourselves as we enter a story of innocence lost, a system compromised, and a life remembered, not for the dreams fulfilled, but for the strength and resilience that shone even in the direst of circumstances. This is the story of Junko Furuta. Junko Furuta, a name that should have been synonymous with songs and aspirations, not tragedy. In the suburban tranquility of Misato, Saitama, in Japan, she was just another 17-year-old with a world of possibilities ahead. Attending Yashio Minami High School, Junko was more than just a student. She was a beacon of hope, a friend, someone's classmate, someone's daughter. Her peers knew her as the girl who always had a smile, who worked diligently towards her dreams. She wasn't just bright, she radiated light. Junko harbored ambitions that soared high, dreams of melodies and stages, envisioning a future where her voice could echo across crowds, where she could be an idol singer that sparked joy in the hearts of many. But those dreams were grounded in a stark reality. Achieving them meant hard work, which is why, instead of spending all her afternoons with textbooks, you'd find her at a part-time job at a plastic molding factory. Not glamorous, perhaps, but it fueled her bigger vision. That job was her stepping stone, a way to afford the graduation trip she meticulously planned and saved for. Her admirers weren't just limited to starry-eyed peers or the friendly nods of approval from teachers. Her good girl reputation caught attention far and wide. It wasn't just about her looks or charm. It was the substance behind her eyes, the intelligence in her laughter. She wasn't merely surviving high school. She was living it with the kind of gusto that could inspire a coming-of-age novel. Even after the final school bell rang, her future shone with potential. She had plans to work at an electronics retailer once college was done, paving her way through practicality into the limelight she so yearned for. But on an ill-fated night, the wings of destiny took an unfathomable turn. Little did Junko know, the path leading back home would detour into an abyss from which she would never emerge. On the chilly evening of November 25th, 1988, Junko Furuta was just like any other teenager, finishing up her part-time job, ready to pedal back home and unwind. Unbeknownst to her, that bike ride would mark the beginning of an ordeal the quiet town of Misato would never forget. Junko was riding alone that night, perhaps reflecting on her dreams of her upcoming graduation trip, or maybe humming a tune she might one day sing on stage as an idol singer. She was eager to get home, ready to tune into the final episode of her favorite TV show, Tonbo. But as she cycled through the streets, Junko caught the eye of someone whose desires were sinister, whose intentions harbored malice, a person who knew nothing of compassion, Hiroshi Miyano. Miyano, whose name would later instill chills down the spine of anyone familiar with Junko's story, was loitering around suburban Misato for the darkest of reasons. He and his accomplice, Nobuharu Minato, roamed with a lopsided intent that night. They were looking for prey, a victim for their terrifying impulses. As Junko was nearing home, her path was disrupted by what seemed like a stroke of misfortune when she was suddenly kicked off her bike. But it was no accident. It was a cruel, calculated move on Minato's part, acting under the commands of Miyano. Terrified and disoriented, Junko was left vulnerable on the ground, an innocent sitting duck in the cunning ploy of these predators. Miyano then smoothly transitioned from a lurking threat to a deceitful protector, approaching Junko with an offer to escort her home, supposedly having witnessed the attack. Yet behind that offer lay a grim agenda that spiraled into the abduction of Junko Furuta. As the innocent girl placed her trust in this stranger, Miyano led her not to the safety of her home, but to a warehouse. There, under the vile pretense of his protection, he unleashed the first act of terror upon her, violating her trust and humanity. He coldly defiled her, commencing what would become a protracted, heart-wrenching saga of brutality. In an even more harrowing twist, Miyano, consumed by his heinous act, made a call to Minato and their associates, Jay Ogura and Yasushi Watanabe, bragging about the atrocity he had just committed. Ogura, in a monstrous display of human depravity, suggested they hold Junko captive, an idea that set in motion a chilling, unanimous plan. The horror escalated when Junko was relocated to a nearby park under the cover of darkness, where her abductors and their twisted cronies loomed. Perhaps feeling the chilling touch of the night or the predatory eyes of her captors, Junko was paralyzed with a terror no person should ever face. The gang, with their false reassurances and threats against Junko's family, information gleaned from the innocent contents of her backpack, cornered her, stripping away her freedom and dignity. And from that park, under the cover of night, they led her into Minato's parents' home, a place that should have been a sanctuary, but became the stage for the cruel and unspeakable. Day after day, they subjected her to physical beatings. Hits with golf clubs and the smashing of her face against concrete were just the beginning of the torture Junko experienced. And in a methodical display of viciousness, they seemed to revel in her degradation, forcing her to perform acts that no human being should ever endure. As the days turned into weeks, her torment continued to intensify. Hung from the ceiling, she was used as a punching bag. Junko's breathing became labored due to blood-filled lungs. The simple act of trying to drink water resulted in vomiting, dehydration, and, cruelly, more beatings. Weights dropped, a cigarette burned skin. Each day brought new horrors. Approaching the end of the second week of their imprisonment of her, they burned her legs and feet, effectively hobbling her and making escape impossible. Junko had her fingers and toes broken, her nails cracked, and her body beaten all over with bamboo sticks. The freezing cold of winter, a time when people find comfort in warmth and family, was used as another form of torture for Junko. Her naked, battered body was left exposed on a balcony. Humiliation continued with forcible acts. Weeks 3 and 4 brought torments that are hard to even speak of. Junko's face, altered by candle wax, and her breasts pierced with needles, her humanity was disregarded completely. A lighter and hot bulb, inserted and manipulated with a cruelty beyond comprehension, shattered inside of her. Injuries to her internal organs were extensive, coupled with burns that left her unable to maintain basic bodily functions. Moving became excruciatingly painful. It took over an hour to drag herself to the bathroom downstairs. Her captors had reduced her to a state where she couldn't even flee. Coming to the end of 44 days, the story of Junko becomes even more heart-wrenching. Her pleas to be put out of her misery fell on deaf ears. Instead, they challenged her to a game of mahjong, and when she won, her victory was met with unconscionable punishment. They beat her mercilessly, dropped an iron exercise ball on her, and set her alight once more. The flames consumed her for hours. All throughout this ordeal, there were moments, glimmers of hope for rescue that were swiftly snuffed out. The police, contacted not once but twice, failed to intervene due to a combination of negligence and deceit. Once by an outsider who learned of Junko's plight, and another when she made the desperate call herself. In both instances, a tragic combination of bureaucratic apathy and fear of the Yakuza's wrath meant that the young girl's pleas for help went unanswered. In her final moments, Junko Furuta was alone, in pain, and far from the dreams she once held. It pains me to recount the extent of her suffering, which I'm certain the words I've used cannot fully capture. This, listeners, was the devastating ordeal of Junko Furuta, a girl let down by not just her captors, but by society's guardians, whose very duty was to protect her. Turning to the investigation process and the pursuit of justice, Junko Furuta's story tells a chilling tale of not just human cruelty, but also systemic failure. The initial response of the authorities to her situation was marred by oversights and inadequacies that ultimately allowed the horror to continue. Let's talk about those fateful moments which could have altered the course of events, but unfortunately did not. On 2 separate occasions, the possibility of saving Junko's life slipped through the cracks. The first instance was when a boy, upon witnessing the unfathomable abuse Junko was enduring, informed his brother. The subsequent call to the police by the boy's parents might have been a beacon of hope. However, when the officers arrived at the Minato household, they were misled by Nobuharu Minato's parents into believing no girl was present, prompting no further action. How much did they know about the horrors happening in their own home? It was said later that they were too fearful of their own son to help Junko. The second critical point came directly from Junko herself, who managed to place a call to the police. Sadly, the boys intercepted her before she could reveal her circumstances, and the return call from the authorities was casually dismissed by the abductors as a mere mistake. Once again, the glaring absence of follow-up by law enforcement representatives sealed Junko's cruel fate. These missed opportunities were compounded by the deeply disturbing inaction of Minato's parents. Despite their suspicions and eventual realization that something was terribly wrong, their fear of possible retaliation from the Yakuza and the concern for their own family's reputation overpowered the dire need to act. The horror only came to an end when, in an unrelated incident, Hiroshi Miyano and Joe Ogura were apprehended for other gang rape charges. During the interrogation, a mention of a murder by the police, a case entirely unconnected to Junko, led Miyano to mistakenly reveal the location of her body, inadvertently admitting to her murder. This led to the quick arrest of the four main perpetrators. Junko's body was recovered from a construction site where it had been dumped, encased in cement inside a large metal drum. What followed the discovery of Junko's body was a series of courtroom proceedings that would leave the public outraged. The sentences handed down to Junko's captors were seen by many as insultingly lenient, especially given the extreme nature of the crimes committed. Factors such as their youth at the time and their reported links to the Yakuza played roles in the sentencing. An attempt by the court to preserve the anonymity of the perpetrators was thwarted by a magazine daring to reveal their identities. The leader, Hiroshi Miyano, originally sentenced to 17 years, appealed and had his sentence increased by 3 years. Nobuharu Minato, receiving a 5 to 9 year term, later moved back in with his mother after his release, only to be arrested again in 2018 for another violent crime. Joe Ogura and Yasushi Watanabe received sentences of 8 years and 5 to 7 years, respectively, which brought additional dismay, considering the extent of their participation in Junko's torture. The verdicts, no matter how justified within the framework of the law, left many feeling as though justice had not truly been served. And for Junko Furuta's family, the sentences were a small consolation compared to the lifelong anguish of losing their daughter in such a barbaric manner. The societal discourse that followed would continue to question the balance between age, affiliation, and accountability, sparking a debate on the effectiveness and fairness of the justice system in cases like Junko's. The aftermath of the crime against Junko Furuta was one of profound shock, followed by a ripple effect that touched not just her family, but the entire fabric of Japanese society and the legal system. Junko's family was devastated. Her parents were left to cope with unspeakable grief, and her mother reportedly suffered a mental breakdown. The pursuits of a normal, happy life, the small routines and joys that fill our days, became overshadowed by a single, horrifying event that no parent should ever face. They carried not just the weight of their loss, but also the burden of justice not fully served, a sentiment echoed by many in Japan. There's no denying that Junko's tragic end cast a long, dark shadow over the legal system in Japan. The light sentences given to the perpetrators, despite their heinous acts, came as a shock and gripped national attention. You had four individuals who inflicted pain and suffering beyond comprehension, receiving sentences that many considered a slap on the wrist. For many, it underscored the leniency often shown to youthful offenders and caused outrage for the apparent disregard for the gravity of their crimes. This case struggled to find its place within society's conversation about crime, punishment, and rehabilitation. It also highlighted the sometimes problematic intersections between organized crime and the justice system. The Yakuza's far-reaching influence was put under a microscope, and conversations began questioning the extent to which such affiliations could sway legal outcomes. The sentences handed down did not just reflect on those four individuals, but also cast doubt and unease over how justice is served and the power dynamics at play. And then there's the cultural impact. This wasn't just a crime. It was an event that shifted the psyche of a nation. There was a national loss of innocence here, a chilling reminder that evil can lurk close to home, even among the young. It challenged the national sense of community and safety and punctured the bubble of complacency that such violence couldn't happen in their backyards. The story of Junko Furuta became a dark fable, a cautionary tale that has been etched into the annals of Japanese lore. For more about this and all of our episodes, check out our True Crime Bedtime Stories Instagram and TikTok accounts. Join us next time for True Crime Bedtime Stories. Until then, sleep tight.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us.
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.